Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. When aqueducts lead to Rome. Here lies one whose name was writ in water. And the aqua fun of the emperors in a little lake nestling in the Alban Hills. Well, thanks very much for joining me. As you'll have gathered from the headlines, this is a program about water. Beginning with words from Pope Benedict XVI.
In a period in which desertification is spoken of, and where we hear time and again the warning that man and beast risk dying of thirst in these waterless regions, in such a period we realize once again how great is the gift of water and how we are unable to produce it ourselves.
Yes, the Creator may have given man water, but man has always shown an ability to harness it, this central and critical element of life. Water. So familiar the sound of its sparkling play here in Rome's streets and squares, in the great fountains of its master artists and architects, in its friendly beaky fontanelle, where the water runs and runs. Following in a tradition going back down the centuries, thanks to the vision and generosity of some emperors, princes of the church, Roman pontiffs. Stay tuned as Susie Hodges gleans refreshing information from Elizabeth Lev, Professor of Christian Art and Architecture at the Rome's campus of Duquesne University.
I think it's one of the most delightful things about Rome, the way that water is everywhere. Everywhere you turn, there's a water spigot or just a beautiful fountain. But that's part of Rome's history. And when the first Romans settled on those seven hills, half the reason was because it was riddled with underground springs. There would never be a lack of fresh water in the city.
And I gather that during the Roman Empire, there were no fewer than 12 aqueducts supplying water to some 1,300 fountains. That's a pretty amazing feat when you think how long ago it was and how few people there were living in the city compared to now.
As a matter of fact, the population of Rome under the empire had 1 million. Now Rome has something like 3 million, which it has to supply water to. But the water supply of Rome grew as Rome did. So Rome started out using its cisterns, underground springs, and of course the Tiber water. But by 312 BC, there wasn't enough water for the burgeoning city on the hills. So the first aqueduct was born, thanks to Appius Claudius, which brought water 10 kilometers into the city. And from then, it grew and grew and grew to end up with a colossal 12 aqueducts.
But then I gather that during the Dark Ages, all that fell into disrepair. And the city turned to using water from the Tiber.
Apparently, on page 2 or 3 of the Barbarian Siege Manual, it suggests to break the aqueducts, and the result of that was to push all the people on the hills back down towards the plain, where they could be close to the only source of water left, which was that of the Tiber.
And how long did they carry on using the water from the Tiber then?
They used it for almost 1,000 years, until the papacies of the Renaissance.
And it was Pope Sixtus IV, I gather, who reconditioned the Aqua Virgo Aqueduct in the late 1400s, and that was the start, wasn't it, of another sort of golden age as far as water is concerned.
Under many senses, Sixtus IV's pontificate was a golden age. The first man to span the Tiber with a bridge, the man who built the Sistine Chapel, and the man who repristined what was known as the best of all the aqueducts, the Aqua Virgo. Because the water from that aqueduct was always known to be the purest, the cleanest, the most limpid of all.
And I gather it's still in operation today, is that
right? Oh, yes it is. The Aqua Vergine is still working today.
But it wasn't just this pope, Pope Sixtus IV, who did all this work. I gather that the successive popes also, they created new aqueducts, they brought more water into the city, built fountains. Can you tell us something about particularly this building of the aqueduct?
Oh yes, not exactly coincidentally. The next great aqueduct-building pope will be Pope Sixtus V, who is pope from 1585 to 1590. He built his own aqueduct known as the Aqua Felice, which means the happy aqueduct. But it actually refers to his first name, which was Felice. And he brought water in from the top of the Quirinal Hill and flooded the city, really revived the construction of the city so that the city would develop back along the Quirinal Hill.
And as far as we know, what prompted them to do this? I mean, was there a religious significance behind it, or was it really just an act of papal generosity?
Water to the city historically has always been connected with generosity. The Appius Claudius who offers this aqueduct, the Marcia family which offers another aqueduct, the emperor who would build an aqueduct. But when the papacy started to rebuild and repristine these aqueducts, yes, it is again an act of great papal generosity, is an act of reviving and rebuilding Rome. But I don't think you can separate this use of water, this flow of water through the city, from that sense of the call to conversion, the sense of baptism, the sense of renewal, all of these implications that water has.
What do you think was the most outstanding in terms of the engineering work concerned, or maybe just in the amount of water that it supplied, if you had to sort of look at all these projects and pinpoint one of them?
If we're talking about the ancient Rome, by the time the empire is underway, by the 2nd century AD, the aqueducts were bringing 1 million liters of water into Rome a day. It was an incredible flow of water through the city. But without the same economic resources that the Imperial Rome had, without the same, even the manpower and slavery that ancient Rome had, without the same population and without the same ability to gather funds, Papal Rome managed to repristine all of these aqueducts and bring back this water that would flow through the city. So it's interesting to see how the underdog, in a certain sense, which was Papal Rome compared to Imperial Rome, was able to recreate that great generosity of water. If it hadn't have been for these really visionary popes, they did many other things. They were concentrating on water, but these popes also had a great vision of creating out of Rome the center of the church, a place where people would come from lands and cities where there isn't much water, or where there wouldn't be bridges, or it wouldn't be so well set out and laid out as a city. And you would come to Rome and you would see through the flow of the water, through the organization of the roads, through the well-constructed city, you would see the greatness of the heart of Christendom.
Now, a lot of this water was going to feed the fountains, and of course Rome is world famous for its fountains. How instrumental was the role of the papacy here in commissioning these fountains throughout the centuries?
There are 1,500 ornamental fountains in one way or another in Rome. About three quarters of them were built by the papacy. The popes created the particularly beautiful fountains are what is known as a show, and it's when the aqueduct first brings the water into the city. It's the moment that the water first emerges from the aqueduct and flows into its first fountain. And the shows are the ones that you know, the people know best. The Trevi Fountain is the show for the Acqua Vergine. The Moses Fountain on the top of the Quirinal Hill is the show for the Acqua Felice. And so they created these very big, beautiful fountains to celebrate the arrival of the water into the city. And then they were responsible for the cute little decorative fountains that would be in a corner of one street or tucked away into a piazza.
So let's take some of these famous fountains. The Moses Fountain, for instance, what Pope helped?
It was Sixtus V who ordered the construction of the Moses Fountain, and it's designed in the form of a triumphal arch. There are three arches, so again, the triumph of water, the arrival of water as it first emerges from the aqueduct. And the image shows Moses striking the rock for the water to leap forth, and then next to him there are these supplementary images of Aaron, the chief priest, and the people waiting for the water. And it's decorated in the front with four basalt lions, which were, once upon a time, Egyptian lions, which are now in the Vatican Museums, but at the time they were lions that had been brought in from Egypt. And it makes a very kind of dramatic sense of triumph, which is a big part of this pontificate.
Now, of course, for most tourists, the Trevi Fountain is the most famous for a number of reasons. Can you tell us something about the papal role here?
Well, the Trevi Fountain starts as an ancient Roman aqueduct, is the show for the Acqua Vergine, which was built by the son-in-law and designated heir of Augustus, who was Agrippa in 25 BC. Now, that aqueduct, like all the others, fell into disuse, but it was legendary for the sweetness and the purity of its water. In the 1640s, Pope Urban VIII had the idea of getting people to move back onto the Quirinal Hill, moving away from the overcrowded area near the river. And he saw that Sixtus IV had already repristined the aqueduct. Water was already flowing into that area. But to create a kind of draw, he projected a very grand fountain for that show. And he started out by hiring none other than John Lorenzo Bernini. And John Lorenzo Bernini began by designing the square, not the fountain, so that the first thing that we all remember about the Trevi is the way we happened on it by surprise. I think everyone who's seen the Trevi Fountain remembers being kind of wandering through streets, wondering where this fountain is, and then the shock and surprise of encountering the fountain. And that was the work of Bernini. Now, the project then lay unattended to for almost 100 years. And it was just let go because it was too expensive, because it was too complicated, because there wasn't much interest. But between 1730 and 1740, the Corsini Pope decided to call up a contest to see who could come up with the best design. And Niccolò Salvi won the contest for designing the Trevi Fountain. Poor Niccolò Salvi didn't even live to see his fountain completed. It wasn't done until Benedict XIV's reign in 1762.
And Piazza Navona, of course, the Four Rivers Fountain there. Is there a papal link to this as well?
Well, that fountain is one of the most famous papal fountains of all. That fountain is, for art historians, it's the fountain that got Bernini back into papal graces. Because there had been a big blow-up between Pope Innocent X and the artist Bernini in 1644, basically. Over the facade of St. Peter's, they were constructing a bell tower, and Bernini was in charge of the construction, and a crack formed in the facade of St. Peter's, and Innocent X, of course, was infuriated. There were a number of Bernini detractors who were ready to whisper in the ear of Innocent X, and Bernini had been sent away in disgrace from papal court. Now, in 1650, Innocent X wanted to build a fountain for what was essentially his front yard. The Pamphili Palace is the palace on the Piazza Navona that looks out over the Four Rivers Fountain. And he wanted a fountain that would combine an obelisk with this ancient Egyptian monument that were beginning to pop up all over the city. But at the same time, he wanted to bring water to the piazza out of that same generous appearance of the papacy. But everybody who presented projects to him presented the same thing, sort of an obelisk, a trough, water. It wasn't very exciting. And the Pope was dissatisfied. Well, Bernini made a sterling silver model of the fountain that you see today, and he had it left in the Pope's apartments. And when the Pope came in and saw that model of the fountain, he said, "This is my fountain. This is the one. Who made it?" And when he heard that the artist was Bernini, he said, "Those who would not use the works of Bernini had better not look at them." And so Bernini was back in papal graces and constructing that wonderful fountain of the Four Rivers.
You've been listening there to Elizabeth Lev, Professor of Christian Art and Architecture at the Rome campus of Duquesne University, speaking to Susie Hodges. Meanwhile, it's time to move on in the broadcast on a very different note. If you wish, you can join me as I go on a visit of poetic nostalgia to a place of memory. My guide is historian Stella Fletcher. Here lies one whose name was written water. This is a clue for our listeners who probably have guessed who we're about to speak about. Stella, he's one of our most famous poets, and his tomb lies here in the English cemetery, sometimes referred to as the Acattolico, or rather the non-Catholic cemetery.
Well, the full inscription on the tomb of Keats reads, "This grave contains all that was mortal of a young English poet, who, on his deathbed, in bitter anguish at the neglect of his countrymen, desired these words to be engraved on his tombstone. Here lies one whose name was writ in water." It was only those last few words that Keats actually wanted to appear on the tomb. He didn't want his name on it at all, just those words. I think it indicates the transience of life. If you were to write your name in water, the water would close as soon as your finger had moved through it. Keats had lived for only 26 years, so his life was more transient than most, even in his own day. So how come Keats came to Rome to die? Effectively, that's what he did. In 1820, it was clear that he was suffering from tuberculosis, consumption. And many people in that period suffered that dreadful disease and were sent to warmer climes, particularly to Italy, for the good of their health. That's precisely what happened to Keats. So in the late autumn of 1820, he and his friend, the artist Joseph Seven, set out by sea. a long, long voyage. And eventually they arrived in Naples. Spent a few days there and then made the journey up to Rome. In Rome, they made the acquaintance of an English doctor called James Clark, who lived near Piazza di Spagna and knew of an apartment where the two young men could stay. Keats and Seven lived in the apartment at Piazza di Spagna for 3 or 4 months. His health improved initially, but in January it declined, and in February it was clear that the end was nigh. A few days before he died, he sent Joseph Seven down here to the Protestant cemetery to see what it was like. And Seven reported back, and Keats thought, yes, I think I should be happy there. So he died in February 1821. Now, we mentioned that this was the non-Catholic cemetery, and indeed the non-Catholics in Rome at that date had a pretty tough time of it. Those who died here had to be buried before daylight. Died, they started out from Piazza di Spagna in the dark. By the time the little ceremony with just a few people was over, it was 9 a.m.
Percy Bysshe Shelley is also buried in this same cemetery. They're linked in death, aren't they?
Linked in death more so than in life. There was a contact between them. Shelley was living in Italy when Keats fell ill with consumption. Shelley did, in fact, invite Keats to stay with him in Italy, but that was about the extent of the connection. More or less, their deaths fell just months apart. Shelley was drowned at sea near Viareggio, in territory belonging to the ex-Republic of Italy. His body was washed ashore on the beach there. Now, there was great confusion over what was to be done with this body of a foreign national. It was eventually decided that it couldn't be removed from the beach, but instead they would have a funeral pyre on the beach. Byron was there. Shelley's wife, his widow, wasn't. It was thought to be too sensitive for women to be present. But a few friends were there on the beach, and they burnt his body. As his chest burst open, one friend reached into the flames and removed the heart. It was a peculiarly large heart. Anyway, over there in the other part of the cemetery, what we actually have is a tomb containing the heart of Shelley plus his ashes. Now, he had little to do with this cemetery, little to do with Rome. He lived elsewhere. But it so happened that a few years earlier, the Shelleys had been passing through Rome and their son died. Their son was buried here. It's unclear quite where, because when a tomb was dug up and investigated, it was found to contain the body of an adult and not a child. So there's a bit of confusion involved there.
These two poets were linked in death for another reason as well, no?
When Shelley's body was found washed up on the beach, he had the published poems of Keats in his pocket. They were more connected in death than in life.
There's also another link, and that's the water link.
Ah, here lies one whose name was writ in water.
Many thanks there to historian Stella Fletcher. And finally, our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover. Get ready for the change of pace and a little aqua fun. You go up to Nemi in the lake there. There's still ships from the Roman times.
Yeah, well,
used to have naval
what's left
battles.
Of it? Well, okay, what the ships that you... what's left, because the Germans burnt them in 1944. But what you had there were two ships of Caligula. And they used to have battles on the lake. But what Caligula did was build two massive ships for parties. Used to have parties on these
massive... Okay, so how do you say ship in Latin?
Was navis.
And navis, and that's parties.
Okay, what are we saying? I don't know what you're going to say.
Aquafan.
Navalia or navicola, or I don't know, festivitatis navicolae. But that's where you get Piazza Navona from, too. Because that was all flooded, too, and they had boats around there in the Middle Ages. It's all the thing.
And today we have places called Aquafan.
Aquafan, okay, yes, Aquafan. Aqua Park.
How would you translate that into Latin? Aqua is already...
Water already.
Water fun.
Aquarum delicie. Delicie, the delights of water. You can say this in a million ways. Mm. And so they had these battles. One was along the Tiber River up near the Vatican, and the Colosseum used to be used for naval battles for a few years, and then they stopped it. And they dug out the floor, and they took out the water, and they had to use the floor of the basement there for animals and different things. But that's the Naumachia, were the ship battles.
The Romans really liked to play, and there's one word still in usage today that highlights this, is ludicrous.
Yeah, ludus, of course, was to play. Ludo ludere is to play.
But ludicrous has a different meaning.
Well, ludicrous means like laughable or jokeable or... In fact, is ludicra in the Latin dictionary, means sport events. So we say ludicrous is kind of funny, but ludicra for the Romans were sport events in the neuter plural, ludicra.
Were they rowdy, the Romans who watched all these battles?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
How do you say rowdy in Latin?
Oh, tumultuosi. Or tumultuenti. Tumultuosi. Yes, and sometimes it got out of hand, and then the emperors would have to send in the police and kill them all.
How'd you say out of hand?
You're going to say ex leges or ex tores. Ex leges. They were out of the law. And there was one time, I think it was Caligula. He was over on the Palatine Hill, and he heard people in the circus screaming and yelling, and his sleep was disturbed, and he told the police to go in, and they killed them all, like 3,000 people.
Oh, so they were
because they were causing trouble for the Emperor Caligula.
Disturbing his sleep.
Yes, yes.
How do you say disturb my sleep?
I don't know. Somnum obturbare.
How do you say nightmares?
Nightmares. That's another. Oppressio nocturna. A nocturnal oppression. How you feel, squashed. Oppressio nocturna is a nightmare. We have all that stuff.
Well, I hope his killing those people gave him nightmares.
But he said, what are these people screaming around there? Get rid of them all. Well, that was Caligula.
A huge thank you there to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite father, Reginald Foster, and he's currently working in the Vatican as the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. If you did, please let me know. Our email address is english@vatiradio.va. Or if you wish to drop me a line, the address is The English Programme, Vatican Radio, Vatican City. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury. Be sure to check out our website. The address is vaticanradio.org/English. Bye for now, and don't forget that we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.